do is to make this available for those attendees that are unable to make it today. We do know that it was relatively short notice, and we were mindful that, you know, dependent upon where you are geographically across the country, you know, your half terms and your breaks were different, and it was really, really difficult to get Alison and Trudy together because they're extremely busy, like yourselves as well. I'm just going to wait and just let a couple more in. Okay, we've got Trudy, I see, and we've got Alison all raring to go. obviously, good morning, and thanks, you know, for taking time out of your busy schedules today to attend the Zoom session. As previously communicated, I'm actually the host, but the session will be delivered by both Alison, lead examiner, and Trudy Weldon, the lead moderator, who I'm sure you've met in the past. And as I've said, the record, it will be recorded and will be made available on the website.
Yes, so, Judy Morton is in the class. Why didn't you tell her?
If you wouldn't mind muting your microphones as opposed to me muting you all, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you. And during the session, you may need to refer to the previous issued documents. So if you've got them, please do have them to hand. I am mindful that we've got old quals and new qual guides, old tutor handbooks, new tutor handbooks, indicative content, which was separated. So as I've said, if you can kindly ensure that your microphones are muted throughout until we pretty much open the session for Q&As. And with that in mind, I'll hand you over to both Alison and Trudy if they want to do a brief introduction. And then obviously we can get the session started. But as I said earlier, if you've got any additional questions outside of today's session, which we aim to conclude by 12:30 because everyone's extremely busy, please do send me an email and I'll do my very best to respond as fast as I can. So with that in mind, Alison and Trudy, I'll hand over to you.
Thanks, Darren.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. Some familiar faces, some new faces, but I'm Alison Thompson, the lead examiner and deputy for moderation. Maybe just a few practical things. If you do have to leave early, that's fine. You don't have to necessarily, break in and tell us. You're okay to just leave when you need to. If something happens and there's a failure, then I guess we'll just rely on Darren to either try and manage that. You know, as long as me and Trudy are on, we'll keep going. As Darren said, it's been recorded. So, I feel a bit uncomfortable about that, but I understand why it is. What we and Trudy, when we were discussing the format of this and the agenda, we want you to get the best out of it. So what we thought we would do, and I will check if it's all right with you, is that we thought we'd focus on the old quals for obvious reasons. The new quals won't be coming through for another 12 months. So we're going to focus on the old qualifications. If you have anything that you want to ask about the new ones, you could either email Darren or put it in the chat box. Darren, if you could possibly keep an eye on the chat box, because I don't think I can juggle delivering and sharing and looking at the chat box. I think it'd be too much for me.
Absolutely fine.
But there might be a relevant question at a relevant time. We thought, because the main issues with the Unit 7 tends to be, I mean, there's issues on each of the criteria, but the main ones tend to be around 4.1, 2 and 3 and 5.1 and 5.2. So me and Trudy thought it might be a really good idea to start with those two, because they're the ones that people tend to have issues with or are getting referred on or end up as borderlines. So we're going to start with those two, and I was going to start with the theory one, and then Trudy will take over with the supervision 5.1 and 5.2. Maybe we'll take questions and answers, during that and at the end of it, because they seem to be, you know, the particularly difficult ones. And then we'll go back to the beginning of the units 1.1 and work through. And if there's any questions and answers, that's great. What I thought I was going to do is go through some of the pitfalls and some of the areas that learners are getting referred on. So does that sound okay? Because that sounds like it's going to meet people's expectations. You just put your thumb up or Okay.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Trudy, does that sound okay? Good format?
Yeah, and I think it's a good idea if after we've addressed each assessment criteria or group of assessment criteria, if there's the opportunity to ask questions then, and then we'll know as we move on that we've dealt with what we need to deal with.
Yeah, it'd be good by the end of the, I think we'll have enough time, but it'd be good by the end of the 2 hours. We've gone through every criteria and everybody's been able to ask what they need to ask. That's the purpose, I guess. It's an opportunity for you to ask us directly. And if we can help you, we will. And if we can answer you, we will. And if we can't, some things like a question before, you know, Darren has to go to compliance and we'd have to get back to you then. Okay. So are you all right with the going for the 4.1 first? I presume, because I don't know all of you, that you're all delivering that and teaching and assessing it, maybe internally moderating it as well. Yeah. So 4.1 is looking at the theory that the learner is trained in to offer when they're on placement. And I say it in that way because it's really important that the learner understands what they are competent in and which counselling theory they're being trained in to be able to offer. So I can only give you the generalisation. If it's the centre that's training the learner in person-centred approach, that's usually fairly straightforward because they know it's person-centred, they know what how to outline the key concepts. It becomes a bit more problematic if a centre's delivering a number of counselling theories that they expect the learner to be competent in. So, for example, a learner submitted that they'd been trained in 5 counselling theories that they were competent to be trained in. And at that level, I probably doubt that would happen and that they are competent in, you know, Gestalt, TA, psychoanalysts. You know, there's a whole range that they're given. So you need to be clear. It's not what theory they've been taught, but it's what they're trained in and what they're competent to offer to a client. So the clearer they are on that and the clearer you are on it, the easier that comes through when they're doing 4.1. Now, 4.1, the reason that it says outline is because they have already done a theory unit as part of the coursework. So in a way, it's a little bit of a duplication, but that's why at level 4, it just says outline. And they've got to outline the key concepts. Now, there has been some issues over the years about what is a key concept, which key concepts, how many key concepts. So just to try and clarify, and it has been an ongoing discussion for certainly in the last 2 years, but even longer about this, that we've eventually come to a sort of guideline on it. And that for the key concepts, they would outline at least 6 key concepts. So when I was looking at person-centred, I could work out there was about, what did I get, up to about 15, there might be more. But there's at least 15 key concepts of person-centred approach, and probably similar to the other theoretical approaches as well. So they need to do at least 6. And what we've, sometimes people can break the centres up, the 6 conditions, but we've put that as 1 key concept. So we acknowledge this, you know, there's 6 different principles there. But from regarding this particular criteria, we would count that as 1 key concept, the 6 conditions. This is for person-centred approach.
Can we make it clear as well, Alison, that we need a minimum of 6 key concepts for each theory that they are identifying they're competent in, not 6 key concepts overall?
Yes. So if they were doing TA, Gestalt and person-centred, and they were competent in each of those and they've been assessed in the competencies, then yeah, they'd have to do at least 6 key concepts from 3 of those, from 3 of the counselling theories. And that, for, you know, if they are trained in those 3 areas, sometimes that is quite a significant amount of work that they have to do, and that we prefer if they word it in their own words rather than just copy and paste in the whole sort of key concepts. They can reference it, but it's good if they can actually, you know, write in their own words what they understand by those key concepts. And all the key concepts mentioned in 4.2 and 4.3 need to be outlined. So sometimes you can pass 4.1, but then you get to 4.2 and they mention a different key concept that they've not outlined in 4.1. Or they might not have outlined it in 4.1, not analysed it in 4.2, but evaluated it in 4.3. So even though each of the key concepts, each of 4.1, 2 and 3 is assessed separately, they do link into each other. So that's for 4.1. I'll just, each series, the end of a series, after 3 months, as a lead examiner, I put a report together of all the pitfalls, which areas that the learners are getting referred on. And that report, you can see that. So if you've not seen it, I do highly recommend that you get a copy of it. You can get it from the ABC website, and it has lots of information on each of the criteria that certainly was built before I was the lead and I've added to it. So usually the learners do this one quite well, and it has improved over the years. It tends mainly to be a person-centred approach, but there are a number of centres that do work in a more eclectic way. And it's just, I'm just reading through what I put. There seems to be more referrals for those centres that are teaching a number of theories. That's not to say all centres that do that. There's some excellent centres that do train their learners in 3 counselling theories, and they complete these criteria successfully. But it tends to be the referrals tend to be those that are working more of an eclectic way. So we need to give a brief summary outlining the key concepts. The no need to outline goals of therapy. Some learners mention Maslow, and we have had referrals about Clarkson and Egan, and unfortunately they're not counted as counselling theories. So if they do mention them, that doesn't mean they're going to get referred on it, as long as they've covered the key concepts of what they've been trained in. But it's just, you know, it's just difficult when they put a large amount of their wordage into other sort of models rather than counselling theories. And sometimes they might in 4.1 talk about techniques that have been outlined instead of theory and key concepts. Any questions about 4.1? Are you all right if I carry on? Yeah, Lorna, you'll have to take your mute off.
Yeah, I've got a question, and that's about integrative. A lot of centres are delivering integrative courses, and although I understand what you're saying, life is so much simpler if we just say just to the students, just do one theory and 6 concepts. If they're integrating relationally a number of different approaches, but the integrating factor is the relationship, then there could be 3. They'd be looking at 18 key concepts, which I just think is not probably where we're at in terms of what a lot of centres, certainly where I am in Bedford, I can only really speak for where I am, where most of us offer an integrative training. And I just think that it's going to get really messy. So really, I think what I'm going to take from this is that I just tell my students to write about one. And that actually isn't what we're really meant to be looking at. You're meant to be looking at what they're doing in practice rather than let's look at this theory and you know, demonstrate that we've learned the theory and the 6 key concepts and can apply them. Because if that's not what they're actually doing in practice, then it seems to make no sense.
Yeah, there are, I think there is a move more towards, you know, centres using different theories and integrating those. And that's fine. And you need to be looking, I guess for me, it's about you as a team. What are you training them to be? And what skills are you assessing? So if they are trained in 3 approaches and you've assessed the skills and that they're competent and that's what they're doing in practice, the centres that are working that way, usually they do very well in these criteria. It's when learners might have got a handle of person-centered approach, they might have looked at two other theories, but they're not actually competent in delivering them to clients, and then they start bringing them, it falls down when it comes to 4.2. So I can't say to you what you should or shouldn't do. I think if they're practicing with three different approaches that they're trained and competent in, that needs to reflect in this. And it's at least six key concepts. So, you know, that's like the minimum. And yes, they would, if there was three, they would have to do that. They'd have to do at least six key concepts for each of those theories that they were trained in.
So Alison, is that what's happening in centres? Are there people here today whose students are writing about 18 key concepts if they're delivering an integrative course?
Yes.
Because I don't know anyone who is, that's all.
Okay, can I interject?
Yeah, it might be good to link up then, and Trudy will maybe share where she's experienced.
But obviously I'm on this morning as the lead moderator for ABC Awards, but I am also a deliverer. And in my centre, we do deliver three theories. We deliver person-centred, TA and CBT. So we teach them to be competent in all three of those theories, and that we do have some students who then will have used all three of those theories with a client. And if that's the client they're using for their case study, then they must outline a minimum of 18 key concepts. And the reason for that is that if somebody is saying I'm applying TA as part of my integration and they cannot outline a minimum of six concepts, then they're not really competent in it. Now, I may have some students who choose a client for their case study where only person-centred and CBT has been appropriate to use. So then they only need to outline 12 key concepts because they're only working with two theories with this client. But we have to think about the fact that, you know, this is a two-year training course at the end of which we are turning out practitioners that we say are competent. So when we're assessing their levels of knowledge and competency, it really shouldn't be too much for them to be able to outline how they are competent in those theories. Otherwise, they shouldn't be using them. And it's very, I've found with my students, it's very doable.
Anything else you want to say, Lorna? Is that helpful?
I'm just sort of like it. Again, I understand what you've just said, Trudy. Of course, if you're doing it, that's wonderful. I still think that you the balance doesn't seem right. So some students are writing about 18 key concepts and some aren't. Some are writing about six. It seems, maybe it's just the way I'm approaching it, fair enough if it is, but yeah. It just seems like you're asking different students to do very different things, but you're gonna, you know, I don't know, yeah. it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense if you're saying you're adamant every single approach, if you're saying, you know, like you said earlier, five different theories, I agree with you, they can't be competent in all of those, that's not possible, and an integration isn't saying that you're competent in three or five different approaches. You've integrated elements of those to form a theoretical foundation for your work is how I understand it. But anyway, you know, at the end of the day, I guess what I always feel, and I've been with ABC now for 10 years, not as long as some, I'm sure, but it's very difficult to shift anything around this unit 7. It seems to be exactly where it was in 2010.
So. Yeah, well, there are changes with the new one, but not a lot of changes in regards to this particular criteria. But they will have covered this. They will have covered three different approaches, three different theories as part of the theory unit. So it's just transferring. They would have covered all the key concepts in those three areas. You know, so it's not like you're starting from afresh that they have to do that.
No, I agree. But I'm just thinking then the 18, you transfer that to 4.2, 4.3. then you're getting in a mess.
That's not what you have to do, though, Lorna. In 4.2, they only have to analyse the concepts that they've applied with this particular client.
That's not the feedback I've had from my students. That is not the feedback I've had.
As examiners, that's the feedback that we give, and that's what we're working with. That's been clear to all the examiners.
Well, that's very interesting, because that's not what I've had. I will find the report.
Yeah, Lorna, make a note of that, you know, where there's been, and, you know, link up with Darren and we can look at that. Okay. All right. So anybody else want to ask?
Anne's just got her hand up.
Anne's got her hand up.
All right. Anne, you have to take your... Mike.
Yeah. Hi, thanks.
Hi.
I just this query about volume, sheer volume of what students produce. Now, obviously, if the student is writing about 6 key concepts, that's very different volume of work to 18. One of the things that we've observed in our centre is lack of study skills. Students don't actually know how to be succinct in actually the work they put down and what is important and what is not. We try and guide them with, for instance, what does analyse mean, what does outline mean, etc., etc. And I'm wondering if ABC has anything that would actually support the succinct nature of any work that is presented. I mean, after all, poor examiners have actually got to wade through sometimes 80,000 words. How can we actually do this together? And is that a consideration in 18 key concepts as opposed to, say, 6? Thank you.
I think there's a few issues, really, Anne, that you brought up there. There's something about teaching study study skills in the key concepts. But how much they should offer and how much they need to write and what depth. Yeah, I mean, I guess that guidelines has got to come from yourself. I know from ABC, they do have, over the years, they've offered a number of different documents that look at command verbs, you know, around analyse and evaluate. I'm not sure, Darren, if we've had anything around like the study skills side. I mean, we don't put a word count on because it's whatever they need to meet that criteria. But some centres do give students a rough guideline of how much to write and what detail. So, yeah, it's getting that fine balance. Is it sufficient? And to be honest, as the years have gone on, I think learners do write more and more for this 4.1. Yeah. But it's
the problem then is where is the distinction between actually what's important, linking it to all of the other key concepts to make one coherent whole, and how much is actually waffle. If a student isn't clear thinking enough to put their work down concisely, are we not doing a disservice to the students who are actually going to qualify as level 4 practitioners? Maybe that's a philosophical query, but I do think it is an important one.
Thank you, Anne. Anybody else? Moira?
Thank you. Going back a little bit, not talking about the different three different approaches, but going back a little bit to the number. So if it's 6 key concepts, I would, with our person-centred students, probably agree that there might be 12 or 15 key concepts that would be referred to. We've had students failed if one small part of a concept was mentioned in 4.1 and not mentioned in 4.2. And I can see people nodding. We've also had students failed when, having analysed the key concepts in 4.1, they have also, as they wrote 4.1, linked briefly to an example with a student. Perhaps one student added a little bit of dialogue and was failed for that, was failed for going above and beyond and saying a little bit more in 4.1. Those are my concerns.
Right, I suppose the difficulty, I mean, obviously that's a real experience for you when you're getting the feedback, and it's trying to get that clarity, isn't it, really, from the examiners. And I can't really obviously make reference or comments about specific people or specific things, but it's good to get the feedback. What I do know as examiners that, you know, that we've increased the number of samples that we moderate, that we meet, you know, sometimes twice a year to do standardisation, to try and iron out some of the things that you've mentioned. And I do think some of those should be improving so that all the examiners, we've got a standardisation of what's acceptable and not. It is unusual for somebody to be penalised if they put extra in, and they've still met the criteria. I think that is unusual, and it probably could be a borderline. I wouldn't necessarily refer if somebody had met the criteria but they put extra in that didn't need to be in there. So I guess it's how the difficulty, I think, for sometimes with the centres when the learners get the feedback is that you don't have any indication of what's a borderline or a good past or something that's just passed. But I guess we can't change the way that we do that because we don't do percentages. So no. That is quite difficult, I think, because you'll get one learner that's passed and one that's third, and it might, you know, it's trying to work out that difference. And I know that we have to work very hard with borderlines to try and get, sometimes it's get a second opinion and sometimes a third opinion as well, because I think the number of borderlines are increasing. You know, so we've had to increase our measures from the examining point of view to try and, you know, maintain that, you know, that learners are getting through when they need to get through, and if it's a borderline, whether it's a pass or a refer. I hope that
Thank
helps.
You. Thank you.
Yes, Merv. Is it Maeve? We have to.
Yes, it's Maeve. Hi. It's really just relating to your earlier point about 6 concepts versus 18. So you don't have word count guidelines then. That's up to every internal centre or every centre to set for themselves.
Well, you don't necessarily have to set a word count. You might give them a guidance.
A guideline, yes.
You know, ABC, we don't have any word counts, and we wouldn't penalise anybody if they'd, you know, sent volumes of work. But obviously it is I think pictures sometimes move around, so I can't always follow where somebody is. But the lady earlier was saying about you know, how hard it is when there's, I've lost my track now because I was looking for somebody. But yeah, it is hard when there's doing that. You've got a lot to, but you've got to remember they've done this in the theory unit. They have already done it.
So really, the difference in the theory unit where they should be more expansive is that they revert back to an outline, which is closer to level 2 and level 3, but it must be comprehensive.
Yeah.
So then you're not looking for analysis and
we're still
referencing.
They can reference, but we couldn't refer somebody if they'd no reference. I suppose we're still looking at the depth of knowledge for a level 4 in the outline, but the reason it says outline is because we know they've already done this in another unit in theory. That was the history of this, of when it was, you know, developed. So that's the background to it. But yeah, we'd still expect them to show a depth of knowledge.
Yeah, in the actual theory unit, which is internally assessed, they're asked to look at the philosophy and the historical development and do comparisons. So that's where the depth is there. But obviously we're not looking for that in the externally assessed piece of work in this Unit 7. So although it is just an outline of the key concepts, it isn't back to level 2 and level 3 because we need them to show the level 4 knowledge. But we don't need all that
extra. So they need to go up Bloom's taxonomy of learning and show the synthesis and show the context. But embed it through the outline.
Yes, we don't need any additional, it's just the concepts.
That's perfect. Thank you very much, appreciate that.
Yes, Angela.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Yeah, I just wanted to ask the practitioners what word count they set for this, because I know ABC don't give guidance, but I'm just wondering what other people do, because one of the students has written 80 pages and she still hasn't met the criteria. So what do other people do?
Is there anybody that wants to offer, or do you think that's something that we could put in the chat and maybe people could respond there? because we've got quite a bit to get through, haven't we? And as we don't set the word limit, I guess it's about the you know, it's the quality, isn't it? Not always the quantity.
Well,
but sometimes
I mean,
people do produce a lot and still meet the criteria, and some people do and don't. Yeah. Are you all right if we maybe put that, so people can put in the chat box, Angela?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Okay with that. So 4.2 is how they apply those key concepts in their practice. And the key thing is analyse. So I guess some of the pitfalls are that they describe what took place, or they talk about the client or the client's process, you know, large amounts of client did this and client did that, or where the client is. And it's really the focus is on the therapist, the trainee, about how they're applying those key concepts in their practice and reflecting on that. So I'm sure you all know what analysis is. I'm not doing it to be patronizing, but it's about them saying why and how. Why did they do that and how did they do it? Why did they apply empathy and how did they do it? So in particular with person-centered approach, it's about breaking down each of the core concepts. Now, to be honest, how people are doing this is changing. Some people do it like as a case study, session by session, and they have to have at least 6 sessions. You know, some might start with session 1 and it's the next 6. Some, it might be the 6 in the middle. You know, it doesn't matter, as long as they cover at least 6 sessions where they've applied those key concepts. But they need to say how they did it and why. So, you know, and it's breaking that down. So they might say, you know, I was very empathic. Well, how were you empathic? And why were you empathic? You know, some learners will talk about being congruent, and actually they'll demonstrate in the writing that actually they were being empathic, not being congruent. So it sometimes that clarity can be lacking, that it doesn't show that the examiner, if the learner knows which key concept they are applying and how they're applying it. So certainly with person-centered, and maybe Trudy can come in a bit about some other approaches, but you know, if they were looking at conditions of worth, it's how did they apply it? And usually my understanding, it would be through one of the core conditions or all 3 of them. You know, so sometimes they do it more as a reflection about where a client might be, regarding their self-worth or self-concept or locus of evaluation. But really, as the examiner, we're looking at how did you apply that key concept and why did you apply it? And it's got to cover, you've got to have been outlined in 4.1 as well. And, you know, usually they give too much client detail and less focus on themselves. So let me make reference to the report that I did. So they need to do at least 6 sessions. Sometimes skills and techniques are being analysed rather than the key concepts underpinning them. So regarding person-centred, why a key concept was applied rather than reflecting on the client's story or process. And then it gives examples of how they might reflect on how do you apply the 7 stages of process. Some new theories sometimes are introduced in 4.2 that haven't been outlined. And then sometimes they might say the person-centred, and then in 4.2 start talking about mindfulness. So I'm sure you know this, but analyse is the process of breaking down each key concept into smaller parts and examining the application in detail as to how and why the key concept is applied in practice. Some learners start talking about what they've took to supervision in this part, and even though that might be relevant, it's not necessarily required in this section criteria. And sometimes only some of the key concepts are analysed in 4.2 rather than being... Sorry, I don't know. I'll have to rephrase that. Core conditions, we would look at it that they should be separated so they can show that the difference of how and why they've applied it. Sometimes they fail to link active listening skills to empathy, so they might say that they've been paraphrasing, reflecting, but they've not actually named that is how they show empathy and why they would do it. Sometimes they describe what took place, and that's not sufficient. Transcripts can be submitted, but they need to back up with an analysis of how and why they've applied it. So reams and reams of transcripts aren't required. So yes, yeah, so some people address it in, I was saying before, in the different sessions. Some people do under the heading of the key concepts. So we can't refer them on either way that they might do it. You know, because there's pros and cons for both sort of approaches. But I would have thought certainly with person-centred, they'll be offering at least the core conditions throughout six sessions. They're not just going to offer it in one session and then the next five not offer it. So, you know, as long as it shows that flow through the six sessions, it doesn't matter if they do it under session headings or under key concept headings. You know, I guess for me, the flow and the preference can be, you know, each session. But still, if somebody did it under key concepts and they showed that they had applied and why they had, they wouldn't get referred based on that. Trudy, have you anything that I've missed out or?
I think you've covered everything there, Alison.
Any questions? All right. Yeah, you okay? So 4.3 is going to lead on. If you're not, just take your mute off and just you know, shout my name or put your hand up. That's okay as well. So 4.3 is evaluating the key concepts that have been outlined, that have then been applied in practice and they've analysed them. And then it's evaluating those key concepts, saying what worked, what didn't. So sometimes evaluation in 4.3 sneaks into 4.2. So no evaluation is needed in 4.2. It all comes into 4.3. And I don't know if you find, Trudy, but quite often in this, some of the learners will put it under headings of the key concepts to evaluate them separately.
Yeah, they do. And I, in my experience, that works really well. But as long as everyone is covered that's been in 4.2.
Yeah.
Others also do it in the same format. So if they've done it session by session in 4.2, they might stick with that same structure in 4.3. Yeah. And that might actually be easy for them when they're writing it, because they can look at their analysis of session one, say in 4.2, and then make sure they evaluate every key concept that was in that session. So there's no right or wrong way of doing it, as long as all the key concepts that were applied in 4.2 are then evaluated in 4.3.
Yeah. So welcome, Julie Roberts. Is there anything you want to add on to that? Julie's one of the examiners.
Yeah, I was just nodding along with what Trudy was saying. I think the headings in 4.3 are quite effective, really. Probably more effective than when people use the sessions as headings. It makes it really clear.
Yeah, I suppose, from an examiner point of view, it makes it easier then to track, doesn't it, the key concepts that have been outlined through. So sometimes that, you know, it can be useful when you're teaching, is to get the learners to, you know, to make, not necessarily highlight for us, but for themselves, what key concepts have been outlined, where have they applied them all in 4.2, and then where are they in 4.3? That might help them to make sure that they've tracked it through. Is there anybody want to ask any questions about 4.2, 4.3, or anything to do with this particular criteria?
Alison, sorry, did you just say sorry, it's Ian Sanderson. Did you just say that everything must be outlined in 4.3 that's mentioned in 4.2?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
I went to everything that's mentioned. A key concept that's been applied in 4.2 needs to be evaluated in 4.3.
Brilliant, thanks.
And can I just come back to a point I made earlier? I've just picked up a copy of a recent report from you. Under 4.2, psychological contact, self-concept and seven stages of process were addressed in 4.1 and therefore need to be analysed here. So that's what I was talking about earlier, that in 4.2, people are being asked to analyse every concept that they have put in 4.1.
Yeah. I think you've got to look at, if somebody's out there doing, say, person-centred, six key concepts, you want those really going through. You know, it's different if they're doing three different approaches.
But I think that's but forgive me, Alison, I think that's where the challenge is for tutors, or certainly for myself.
Yes.
How do I talk about that with my students? If on the one hand, well, you can do the six, because you've mentioned six. If you've done 18, you can't, you don't have
I know what you're saying.
It's confusing, I think.
And I know what you're saying, Lorna, and we've come across this a few times where on centre, you know, the learners were putting maybe 10, 15, but not applying all those, because you wouldn't apply all of them all the time. And like I said, this is where we've been trying to tighten up on standardisation. Would you agree, Trudy and Julie?
I would. And actually, I think we have to take on board, if there's been some feedback that you've received and somebody's been referred in that way, which isn't something that we as examiners have agreed on, then we need to ask perhaps Darren to look at this when this feedback comes back. Because as examiners, we have agreed that not every concept is appropriate for applying with clients. So we don't want them to make it up or pretend that they have if they haven't. Yeah. So I would hold our hands up there, Lorna, and say, I don't know who sent that feedback or why, and obviously you don't, but that's something we as examiners need to look at to make sure that that's done consistently. And we'll ask Darren and whoever is dealing with the allocations and then the feedback coming back as well to keep an eye on that for us. It is something we need to know about.
That's actually really helpful, because it's been that's been tying us as a centre in knots. Yeah. Because you're right, you don't want to pretend, I can demonstrate that key concept in 4.2 because I have to. That just makes no sense of the work, does it?
No, that's not what I'm looking for.
No, and look, that's why we need the feedback through ABC, because I, you know, they don't all get double marked. I only moderate a small sample, and I might not know that issue's happening. So if you might get really frustrated with it, but unless it goes back to ABC, who can then look at it, and if it needs to be, they can decide and work through, because you need to work out, is this an appeal situation or not?
And we are happy as examiners to take, you know, sometimes we will get a question from a centre that then is sent through to us, asked us to explain our marking. And I think all of us are happy to do that. It increases the validity of what we're doing. We want to be better all the time, and we can only do that with feedback.
And I'm more than happy, sorry Trudy, I'm more than happy to take that feedback. And as Alison pointed out there, you know, there is occasion when we do get that feedback, and I will go externally to the examiner and request, shall we say, a deeper response in terms of a query that a centre has in terms of a report. So if any of you have any reports that you want me to look at to go for further advice and guidance in terms of the examiner or another examiner, as Alison said there, we do second mark portion, obviously, of the allocations that come in, but obviously not them all. But if you have got individual queries relating to examiner feedback, then please send them through to me straight away, because if we don't get that feedback, I can't read every single report that comes back before I send it to them. I'm more than happy to take
queries
in relation.
There were some issues a few years ago, and we are ironing those out, but we need more of that feedback. So keep feeding it back.
Thank you for that. That's really been helpful.
Beverly?
Yeah, just a comment really on 4.1, when it says to outline and explain the approaches that you've been trained in, perhaps it would probably make sense to say the approaches you're competent in, because as somebody was saying, you might be trained in, you know, several if you're doing an integrative approach, but you're not really competent in it.
No.
So this might be something, maybe.
Yeah, I think you're right, Beverly. I'm not sure what's in the new document, whether we've put that, but it's you as tutors to know, when you're doing your skills unit, what are they being assessed in that they're competent to go out to be with a client? I think it's not... Sorry, go on.
I think the reason that we say training as well, because sometimes we get submissions from individuals who've done their own reading or done a CPD course and start to use that in their evidence submission when their college hasn't trained them in that, and we don't want that to be happening. So perhaps it's trained and competent is what we're looking for.
There was, sorry, Myra.
Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to make a brief comment that certainly for some people, from some students, because the centre wouldn't pay, to actually have an appeal, £100 I think for an appeal, is quite costly with the risk that one might lose the appeal. I just wondered whether that cost could be reviewed. It's certainly on one occasion in the past put us off appealing. We were fairly certain the student should have got through, but £100 is quite a lot.
On that point, Moira, I will take that. I will take that back, and I will have a look at that in terms of the appeal fee. But as you know, if successful, then that at the moment that cost is refunded.
Yes, I realise that. Yeah.
However, I will take that, and I will come back to you in terms of that. Most definitely.
Thank you.
All right. Are you I'm just aware of the time. Are you all right if we move on to criteria 5.1 and 5.2? Yeah. Right, Trudy, over to you.
Good. So if we look at 5.1, first of all, what we're actually looking for here is for the learner to be able to analyse what they have learned from taking issues that they've encountered with a client to supervision. So first of all, this needs to be one client that is different from the client used in the theory case study. And it needs to be a client that they've worked with over a period of time, because they need to have taken a minimum of 2 issues to a minimum of 2 supervision sessions. And the majority of the evidence that we're looking for is an analysis of what they've learned as a result of taking each issue to supervision. But of course, in order to demonstrate that, they need to identify each issue. They need to briefly explore how that was worked with in supervision. And then the main body of evidence needs to be a reflective analysis on what they've learned as a result. What we do get sometimes is the issues are not clear, or the issues are confused. They need to be 2 separate, distinct issues. And sometimes what we'll get is a big explanation of what the supervisor said or suggested, but then no analysis of what the learner learned as a result. So it is good for them to be able to identify the conversation that went on between them and the supervisor, and maybe some of the guidance they got from the supervisor, but then they need to take that further and analyse their own learning. So what the supervisor suggests isn't learning in itself, but what they've then reflected on and learned as a result of that is what we're looking for. I think another area where they sometimes fall down is they tell us what they've learned, but it's not clear that it's come from supervision, because they've not, first of all, said how that was explored in supervision. So we don't dictate how this should be done, but the most effective submissions are those that identify each issue separately and separately how each issue was worked with in supervision, and separately what was learned as a result of taking each issue to supervision. I think it providing that structure makes it a lot easier for the students themselves. Any questions around that?
I think for me, 5.1, they need to prepare for which client they're going to choose with the supervisor, maybe with the tutor as well, because you definitely get an impression that they've left it to the end of the second year and they're just trying to think of somebody that they'd worked with, or it's the first client. And sometimes there's not enough evidence really for us to assess. Or they might choose, and we say at least 2 issues. So it says at least 2. So if they choose, oh, this is my first client and I wasn't confident, and the second issue is I was struggling with silence, there's not usually sufficient evidence to meet this criteria. So they need to, you know, so that's why now when we're giving the feedback, we're saying, what did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about your client? What did you learn about theory? What did you learn if there's any ethical issues? So they might bring an ethical issue. Somebody might have been very suicidal and say what action they took, but they've not said what did they learn in supervision. I mean, there's masses of learnings with ethical dilemmas, but it's unusual for us to get an ethical dilemma as an issue. So it's just them I think Trudy's right, when they set it out as the separate issues, they might take two or three issues to that first supervision, and that's fine as well, you know, but then they have to analyse the learning that they've gained and then follow it through into 5.2.
Hi, can I just clarify something on that? Is it possible to have two clients and two issues?
No, it's got to be one client.
If the one client hasn't got more than one issue?
Well, first of all, it's not the client's issues. It's not the client's issues that are being taken into decision. It's the trainee counsellor. Issues that they've encountered might be transference, it might be something that's triggered in themselves.
Yeah.
I think it would be highly unusual and concerning, actually, if a trainee counsellor could only identify one issue from working with a client. But if that was the case, then they need to pick a different client.
Thank you.
Okay, are we okay to move on to 5.2 then? Yeah. So 5.2 is asking the learner to evaluate how what they learned and which they've analysed in 5.1 has impacted on the work that they've done with the client moving forward. And we ask for over a minimum of 2 subsequent client sessions. So what the learner needs to do is reflect back on what learning they've analysed for each issue in 5.1. And then use that learning as a basis for their evaluation in 5.2. So as a result of what they've learned and reflected on, what did they do differently with that client? And we need examples of what they did with the client. Now, it could be that they, as a result of taking an issue of transference to supervision, they've done a lot of learning on self and therefore were feeling differently when they sat with that client in the future. And it allowed them to be more open about what they're exploring. Or it could be boundary issues that they've not been able to address with the client before, and they've learned that they needed to have more confidence in self, or to be assertive, or to be confident about why those boundaries are there. And then in 5.2, they can evaluate how that has impacted on what they've done. What have they done differently as a result of that learning? Now, what we sometimes get is just a repeat of the learning that took place in 5.1. Or sometimes we get students identifying what they did differently, but it's not clearly linked to the learning from supervision. So all of those things, all of those factors have got to be present, must be linked to the learning. I think as well, Alison and Julie will probably support me on this, that sometimes 5.1 and 5.2 are very confused, and you'll get more learning in 5.2 than in 5.1, and some evaluation in 5.1. And that might seem picky when we pick up on that, but it's important that the learner understands what analyse means, and that the analysis is in 5.1, and that they understand what evaluation means, and therefore that is in 5.2. So that's what we're looking for, clear structure across the two assessment criteria. Your microphone's off, Alison.
If they do evaluate in 5.1, when it should be in 5.2, as long as they still do that evaluation in 5.2, yeah, they wouldn't be penalised.
Yeah.
But often, I would feed back, you know, that some evidence is in another section, if it's going to be a referrer overall anyway.
Yeah, because that helps them then to restructure it for the resubmission. We got any questions or concerns around those two assessment criteria? No? Well, that's good.
Okay. All right. Are you right to move on? Yeah? Yeah. So we'll go back to the beginning. Criteria one. Are you all right with that, Darren? We're doing okay.
Absolutely fine. Wonderful. Thank you, Alison. Thank you.
So hopefully we should go through these, but it's just if there's anything that you want to ask about them. So the first one is about where they're reflecting on their placement and a demonstrating understanding of one of the placements. Usually they choose the one where they've done the most hours in there. If they do put about other placements, that's okay, but we don't assess that. We only assess the one, the main one. So usually this criteria is addressed pretty well and is improving, certainly over the last 12 months. They usually do describe the purpose of the counselling service, where they're doing the placement, and it's definitely improving about the organisational structure. Some of the pitfalls are when they just put a chart in and there's no explanations of the roles and responsibilities. And it's important that they include where the counselling service fits into that organisation, and you know who's there overseeing the counselling service, who's managing it, and it is occasionally you might have a sole trader who's took some trainees on, and as long as they're clear about that, then it's, you know, the organisational structure might be very minimal, but they have to do a brief outline of the roles and responsibilities of those people in the organisational structure. In regards to the ways of working, this is usually done very well. The pitfalls tend to be if they describe the ways of working of the placement as a whole, but don't mention how the counselling service, what is the way of working there. And I think in the guidelines, it has a list of things that you'd expect them to cover to show that understanding of how they've worked and where the counselling works, whether it's appointments, referrals, record keeping, some details, so they've got an understanding of the counselling service. And then policies and procedures, two policies to be outlined, and briefly to look at the procedure, how they implement that in the counselling service. So that is 1.1. Is everyone okay with that? Any questions? Anybody we need to ask anything? Christine? Yeah? Oh, you're all right. Good, thank you. Right. 1.2. Explain the relevance and application of one piece of legislation. This tends to be done quite well overall, I think. A lot of centres, the learners choose GDPR. Would you agree, Julie and Trudy?
Yeah.
And most do that fairly well. Obviously, if they're missing whole chunks out of how they've applied it, it might get referred, you know. With no sort of yardstick on every single piece of legislation what they've to do, but they've to show an understanding of that legislation, and they've to choose one piece of legislation. So sometimes learners might put they want to look at safeguarding, and they describe the safeguarding policy, but they don't name the piece of legislation it's under. Sometimes they choose a piece of legislation that's not really relevant to where they're working, and they don't say why it's relevant. And we have seen, would you agree, Trudy, some very strange pieces of legislation that learners are choosing. I'm not sure why they're choosing that piece of legislation when there's, you know, there's quite a number. I mean, I think we listed them a few years ago. There was about 10 or 15 that is relevant to counselling. And I think with the new qualification, I think that's changed. We actually, in the end of the criteria, I think we look at, they have to talk about GDPR specifically. So, yeah, is there any questions about that? It's them understanding how they've applied it in the practice. Yes, Beverly, did you want to say?
I'm just thinking, since we are moving away from Europe, is GDPR still relevant, or is it just data protection?
I think at the moment it's still GDPR, but I don't know. We might have to look at that.
Okay.
Yeah, because things are changing, aren't
they? I think I read somewhere. I can't remember where I read it. Okay.
I'm not sure, Beverly. I'll have a look myself. Okay. All right. But thanks for raising it.
Okay.
So, yeah, a lot of learners are choosing the Inequality Act. And they might say that about when access into a building. But we were looking for a bit more than that. You know, there's so many of the corrected characteristics. They could look at how do you apply that in your counselling practice or in the counselling service. So Yeah, Julia, do you want to say anything about that one? Because that keeps coming up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's just a sort of broader view on how it's actually relevant and applied in the counselling placement. It seems to be lacking. They often, they've just sort of honed in on one aspect, and you know, there's not really given a broader view of how the legislation's applied in the placement.
Yeah, I think that links back to what Alison was saying, actually, that it's very dependent on the legislation that is chosen, because sometimes it's quite obscure, so it's only loosely linked to what they do, so that really decreases the amount of content that they can put in. And I think that's why we see that the data protection and GDPR legislation is used more often, because it is extremely appropriate and there are so many things that they can write about in relation to that.
Yeah. Anybody got any questions? No? And then 1.3 is evaluating their placement experience, and it could help them to evaluate in the different areas, whether it's the organisation and the structure of it, the ways of working, policies and procedures. It just is a natural flow, rather than just saying whether they enjoyed it or not, or how many clients they've had. It's really evaluating the placement on all of those different areas. But on the whole, this criteria has done very well.
Yeah, I think as well that these criteria have done a lot better since Achieve Life came in, simply because you can click on at the top of each evidence box, there's a something you can click on for guidance. Yeah. And I would encourage you to get your learners to keep doing that and check in then, have they covered all of the content that they're being asked to cover? Because for this one in particular, it actually explains that they must cover all of those particulars that they included in ways of working in 1.1. And I think it will help the students when they're submitting moving forward to just keep checking on that guidance and make sure they've done what they're being asked to do, and then that will preclude any unnecessary referrals, really, just because something's been missed.
I can just say that, having received and been inundated with obviously calls, not just from centres but obviously from candidates, that is something that some candidates out there are unaware of.
Right.
So as you've said there, it is good advice that they do click that tab at the top of the page, which clearly explains what they must be covered, as Trudy said there, in particular in 1.3, what areas, you know, of the placement need to be evaluated and taken from 1.1. So it is good advice that you do ask your candidates to make sure that they are familiar with the layout and the information that's given on the Achieve Life platform.
Yeah. Okay, you're right to move on. Moira.
Now, I was just going to say that the Achieve Live wording and getting the students to look at that guidance is so valuable. It's so useful, and it really does help them understand what they need to do.
Yeah, it's there available to them, isn't it, as they're doing it? Yeah. Trudy, were you about to pick up 2.1 and 2.2?
Yeah, okay. So in 2.1, the learners are simply asked to upload the working agreements that they've got in place. And all we are looking for is the mandatory ABC working agreements. Now, we know that some centres have their own working agreements, which is really good practice, because you might have a three-way or four-way working agreement. And some supervisors and placements have their own working agreements as well. But in order to meet the requirements of this submission, we are just looking for the ABC mandatory working agreements to be uploaded there. It's really important that they are signed and dated. And sometimes we see them being uploaded and they've not been signed by the trainee or by the supervisor or placement, or they've either not been dated or they've been dated incorrectly. Working agreements should be signed and dated prior to client work starting, not just as they are submitting, because that just evidences to us that the working agreement hasn't been in place when it should have been in place. So it is just checking on those things, that they are signed and dated correctly. And then that is a really simple pass, that assessment criteria. For 2.2, they're asked to evaluate the importance of each of those working agreements. What we are looking for is that the content of each working agreement is evaluated with regard to how effective it is and how important it is for both parties, so for the trainee and for the supervisor, for the trainee and for placement, and also might be relevant in terms of protection for the client, some of those things that are in those working agreements. So we want a substantial part of the content of each working agreement to be evaluated, not just an overview. Now, the ABC working agreements are in sections, so the learners can go through each section and evaluate the importance of each section, and that's what we're looking for. Sometimes what learners tend to do is start to evaluate their supervision or how well their supervisor did or how well their placement did. And again, that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for an evaluation of the content of each of the working agreements.
Ideally, all of their supervision should be covered with an agreement. And if there's a supervision agreement from all the supervisors, in the ideal world, they should all provide a report at the end as well. There has been a few hiccups, I'm right, Darren, that they've had a sufficient supervision from one supervisor and had additional supervision from group, and they might not submit the group supervisor or the group report. So they wouldn't necessarily get referred, but really whoever's supervising their practice whilst they're training should have an agreement and they should have a report at the end.
Yeah, and I think they wouldn't get referred if they didn't include a report from the group supervisor, as long as they weren't reliant on that group supervision to meet their minimum supervision ratio. Any supervision that they are counting to cover their hours as part of the minimum ratio, we do need a report from that supervisor. So it's only if it's additional over and above where we wouldn't need a report.
I just wanted to ask, because we've had, with COVID and everything, we've had a lot of students that have had 1 hour, 2 hours covered. And the supervisor that has covered that has been asked to do a full report, which they've really not been happy about. I know when we came up to London to do the supervision last year, there was some talk that there would be a shorter contract put in, that there would be a shorter report template put in for people that are just doing 1 hour or 2 hours that are stepping in.
Yeah, thanks for raising
not
that.
Fair for them to do so, yeah. When the students are having to pay for that on top, it's there's not a lot you can put in there.
I agree with you, Kay.
Yeah, good point. It's something we discussed at our last examiner standardization meeting, but since then COVID has happened, and what we've got at the moment is the additional COVID, the additional support because of COVID form. So if they've had a different supervisor because of any COVID reasons, if that's just identified on that additional form, I think we would be okay with that. Would you agree?
And they don't have to do a report?
And not have to do a report. Just a brief summary of the additional support they've provided.
That would be absolutely fine, Trudy.
Yeah.
Obviously, we don't expect candidates to go out when they've only, you know, had an hour or two with a supervisor and then they're struggling to get the report. And obviously, there's very little that that supervisor can put in there. But as if they can just add that information onto that additional support form that's submitted with the 3.1 and 3.2, then the examiners will be able to quickly identify where that information is.
Yeah, if your centre has like a three-way contract or a four-way contract, that's brilliant, but you don't need to submit it, and it won't, even if they evaluate it, we don't can't count that as the evidence. You just have to evaluate the ABC template. It's also important for US centres to make sure the placement, who is the manager and who is the supervisor, because there have been cases where the manager has been the supervisor and it has caused problems. And it's obvious when you read the portfolio, the learner has had issues with that. And we, as an examiner, we don't can't really, we wouldn't refer based on that. And our practice is we would then email ABC and say, can you feed back to the centre? There might be a legitimate reason, but it's just making sure that they've got the supervisor, even if it's in-house, is separate from who's managing them. Right. Are you okay? Any questions? Are you okay if we go on to the logs? 3.1 and 3.2 is about the records of the client logs and the record of the supervision. I think on the whole, the records of the client logs are all right. There's still odd problems where they don't put the full date, and that's really hard for us then to assess if they've had enough supervision as to when the counselling has took place. But on the whole, it's done quite well. The ideal is to use the combined log, and that makes it so much easier, hopefully for the learner, but certainly for the examiner as well.
Well, I think that's mandatory now anyway, isn't it, to use that combined log?
It is.
Yeah, it is, but they're not all, it's still this, it depends when they've started, doesn't it, and when they're finishing. Yeah. They're still coming through that are on the mandatory log.
And I think that's a good point for us to raise, actually. If they started prior to September 2017, then the combined log wasn't mandatory, but it is now. But we as examiners don't want to be referring learners because they're using the wrong log. We really don't. But we would really ask you as centres to please try and make sure you've got the most up-to-date version of what we're asking you to use. Because, you know, we want to be fair, we want learners to pass. We don't want to refer them on these things, and we try not to do that. Sometimes if they're using the wrong documents, that leads to errors in their recording of it, which makes it more difficult for us. So really encourage you all, please, to make sure that you've got the most up-to-date versions of forms that ABC provide.
Yeah.
And if any of you out there are unsure, then please do let me know, and I'll gladly make sure that you've got the correct documents that you should be using, or I can direct you to the website where they're held. So if you've got any doubts in terms of what documents you should be submitting, whether it's pre-2017 or it's the updated ones, or it's the newly created version for the new call, which went live Jan 2020, do let me know and I'll make sure that you've got the correct copies.
Right, the client dates need to be in date order, not in placement order. You know, this is the criteria that takes most of the examiner's time if it's not on the, you know, the correct template, and the, you know, because it takes hours. And try, if especially on Achieve Live, that it's one document. You know, sometimes we're having to open 15, 20 pages, and it's really challenging, and it takes hours to do. So, you know, they want that smooth run through this one. So it's just important that, you know, you can't mark this unit, but you can at least check it or get them to check it as well. All records should be in ink, not pencil, and we need to be able to read it and that it's legible. Not to use dittos or crossing out. A running total is needed so we can see how many hours they're doing, and briefly state the theme. I think we all know that about the hours for under 18s, that it can do 50 hours with a young person. Just a brief theme of the session. I'm just reading through my list where the problems are. Yes, so the combined one, it has supervision separate. Some of them are coming in on the old format and they're putting supervision in between, but then not dating it. So this is where the 3.1 and 3.2 can be linked. So they might look like they've met all the criteria on 3.1, but when you come to 3.2, they've not had sufficient supervision, then they're going to have to redo 3.1. It should be signed by the tutor and the supervisor. So 3.2 is adequate supervision. I don't really want to go through what the rules are, but has anybody got any questions about, because it still is a problem, especially if, you know, they're not having adequate supervision, they've got to get referred, and then trying to work out how many hours that they have to redo. You must have all come across this from feedback with learners. Is there anybody that needs to ask me a question, me and Trudy or Julie, anything about this? It should be straightforward having adequate supervision, but trust me, it's not straightforward.
Can I just say as well, on the logs, there's one column which most often isn't filled in correctly, and it's because of the wording. It's the column which says supervision hours claimed from clients. And what they should be putting there is the number of client hours they've taken to this supervision session. So the number of client hours they've had this period of time, so since they were last supervised, And that makes it easier for us as examiners to work out, are they working to the right ratio? So we're not looking for a running total of how many supervision hours they've had. We're looking for the number of client hours they've taken to this supervision that they've had since the last supervision.
And indicating whether this supervision's individual or group is important, because can't assess whether there's been sufficient supervision unless we know if it's individual or group, and that's not always filled in.
With the number of hours, and obviously we have been getting updates from there and regarding how many hours could be done on online. So we follow the same guidelines, which maybe keep on changing?
Well, they're changing monthly as we move forward, because I mean, in reality, this was always meant to be a face-to-face qualification and therefore face-to-face client work, but we just can't do that at the moment, and we can't dictate that because it would really disadvantage the existing learners and any new learners. So we're having to move those goalposts all of the time.
Yeah.
And what was looked at was that on average trainees do 12 client hours a month, so it's gone up by 12 client hours each month it's acceptable to have remotely. Now I think I'm right, Darren, that currently ABC is at 66 hours.
That's correct, Trudy. We're at 66 at the moment, and by the end of this week, I will be updating and sending out some guidance. As you've said, the goalposts are changing on a regular basis, and we at ABC have tried to be as flexible as possible, bearing in mind that this ultimately is or should be a face-to-face qual, but because of the times that we're in, you know, we have to keep regular contact with other AOs to make sure that we're sending out the same message in terms of what we can permit. I think I mentioned earlier before the recording started that we have been updating this on a monthly basis, and we have been increasing that because of the current COVID situation. Obviously, the BACP did throw a spanner in the works a month or so ago in terms of their website putting out the announcement that candidates needed to ensure that they accrued more face-to-face than remote. However, that information was put on their website way after the awarding organisations had been flexible in their approach for remote. And it wasn't surprising that information was quickly retracted from their website. And then I contacted the BACP, who gave me quite an informative response saying that they'd been removed and that they were being flexible, and hence why I did send that email out to all the centres, because I didn't want students out there worrying that it was going to affect their affiliation in terms of professional membership bodies. But as I said, we will be putting out something by the end of the week, and we don't envisage increasing it at the moment. Well, that was the plan until the new lockdown was announced. Just put a template out there. And deal with it on a case-by-case basis, but that may slightly change now because of obviously what was announced the other day by our dear friend Boris. But I will let you know when that's up and out, and that will go out to the YouTube mailing list, and it will be uploaded onto the website.
My only concern is, although it hasn't been a concern yet, is some of my students got quite a number of clients due to lockdown. Right, because there was more demand, and the placements they were working with were very quick to change the process, and others got very less, right? Because some of the placements they just shut down, right? That if someone has acquired more hours, and by the time they submit their unit 7, right? And the things are hopefully better, and say they have done 66% hours, which is according currently, by the time they submit, if it is 40%, then they need to do more face-to-face.
Well, it's not going to reduce.
Sorry?
It's not going to reduce.
No, it won't reduce. But okay, Melinda, what it will do is...
I'm expecting it to increase the way things are going, actually.
If you've got any candidates out there at the moment that are approaching or are at 66 hours, then please do send me an email. And what I will do is I will try and get that form out to you, which can be completed by both parties, requesting why you personally want or this individual needs to accrue more than the current 66. That's pretty much as flexible as we can be at the moment, because it's just changing on a daily basis. And what I can put out there tomorrow, by the end of next week, it may well change again. It's just reminding censors that announcement that the BACB did put on their website, there's nothing to say that they won't reintroduce something. I doubt it, bearing in mind that it would seriously impact on their membership numbers, shall we say.
Well, the current situation from BACP is that there is no limit on the number of face-to-face hours, remote hours remote. That can be done. So I think they find it difficult to go back on that now, because once trainees are working to that, that's what they're working to, and it would preclude them applying for registration. So I think that's how it's going to be moving forward.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so for preparing for Unit 7, you're going to introduce it really as soon as you can, but certainly as they're entering into their second year, there's 20 guided learning hours allocated for Unit 7, and this is how, you can help learners prepare for Unit 7 in advance, rather than waiting till literally they've finished everything and it's the last month and then they go to Unit 7. There's so much work they can be doing as they start the placement. Would you agree with that, Trudy?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I think for me, probably, it's a 2-year course and they've got internal work to focus on, but definitely in the second year, if the learners are aware of the assessment criteria and the requirements, they can be pulling information together. And in terms of the current 1.1 policies and procedures and the ways of working in placement, would encourage the learners to get that as soon as they go into placement, because they should have knowledge of it to inform their working. And then the majority of that's done, it's just the write-up. And again, if they know what's required of them in terms of the theory case study and supervision case study, they can be thinking about that as they work with clients and they go to supervision, which ones would be most appropriate for completing these criteria.
Anybody got any questions?
Hi.
Hi, Dawn.
Hello. I've got some questions about students that are actually on courses that started before September 2017 and still haven't finished, which I have still got a few. So they will have been using all the old logs and the old agreements as well, which obviously, hopefully, they would have got signed at the beginning of their placement. So when they submit, they will be submitting all the old paperwork.
That's all right.
Still okay?
Yeah, we're aware of that. It is a problem, it is an issue, but regarding Unit 7, the examiners would be aware, hopefully they'd be aware of the date. Once we see one of the old forms, normally you just check what year that learner's started.
Right, okay. Yeah, because obviously they can't change it, especially if it's all been signed.
No, that's all right.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Dawn. Anybody, any questions? This is your space and time. Well, you've got our attention to ask.
Well, can we just address 6.1, because we do still...
All right, sorry, yes. Yes, yeah, we haven't done that, have we?
Okay, yeah. So for 6.1, first of all, of course, they have to upload their supervisor reports, at a minimum 100-hour report, but a lot of learners have a midway report as well. And again, sometimes the written part of this is done well, but then the supervisor report hasn't been signed or dated, which means that this gets referred because we have to get those signatures. And that's really important, because the back page of that 100-hour report is asking the supervisor to confirm that by signing this, they believe this trainee is now competent to work with clients. And then from that, they are asked to use the content of that supervisor report to evaluate their own development over the period of time that they've been working with clients. And I think a lot of these are done really well. It's just occasionally we get some that are just very brief. They may pick one or two comments from the supervisor report and base an evaluation around that. When a really good one would be looking at each section of the supervisor report and evaluating themselves and their development based on feedback from each section of that report. Something else came into my mind then as I was talking, and that's gone completely. You got anything to add to that, Alison?
I don't think so. Just all supervisors' reports should go in. If somebody doesn't put a 50 hour, we wouldn't refer based on that. It's good practice, but we wouldn't refer based on that. Occasionally there's some issues when people supervise, something happens with the supervisor or they can't get a report, but usually dissenter would liaise with Darren to look at how we can resolve that. So if you're in that situation, just let Darren know, you know, ahead of the time, and then we can try and resolve it. Sometimes if it's just down to a signature or a very small point, rather than refer, sometimes we can go back to Darren and say, can you get them to get this date? Or, you know, so we're here to try and get the learners through the best that we can.
Definitely. If a learner hasn't referred on any of the other criteria, we wouldn't refer them for a lack of signature or a date. We would ask Darren to contact the centre to get that put on. But if they have referred on previous criteria, then we just add this to our feedback that needs to be done for the next time.
Yeah, and I do go back, as Trudy said there, there are occasions when there is a relationship breakdown between the client and the supervisor, for whatever reason he or she may not be able to get that report. Mm-hmm. But as Trudy said there, and Alison said, if you can let me know in advance of that, then obviously I can let the examiner know in advance so that, you know, it's not referred and it's not sent back at extra cost, obviously, to the candidate. So please do let me know in advance. And as you've said there, if there's missing signature things, then the examiners do come to me and I do come to you guys to obviously get that rather than referring the portfolio.
I think as well here, the key word is evaluate. Sometimes what we get is an explanation. So it's much more rare now, and I think the evaluations have improved, but because they're being asked to evaluate their own development, if they only explain what's been written in the report, that would be referred for a lack of evaluation. So it's really to remind the learners what it is that is being asked for in the criteria.
Yes, 6.2 is very similar, isn't it? They have the placement reports or multiple reports if there's two or three placements. Equally, it has to be signed, and then they have to evaluate, you know, their learning from that placement, from the feedback that they've got from the placement. So you'd expect them to make some reference to the feedback. Sometimes this is minimal because the report that we ask them to complete on the placement is very minimal. There's not always a lot of piece of evidence that they can reflect on. And then 6.3 is the professional development, what plans they've got, not necessarily what they've already undertook, and it's not about personal development. On the whole, this is usually passed, you know, most learners pass on this one. And if you haven't started with the new quals, you know, it'd be really useful for you to have a look, because there have been some, I think, significant changes and improvements for any new cohorts. So that started, was it last year in January 20?
Yeah,
January 20 was the first cohorts that got registered.
I think the general feedback and the consensus, not only from the onboarding days that we did, but the feedback in terms of this redeveloped unit, shall we say, has been quite positive. Obviously had, you know, quite a few requests from centres that want to switch their learners to this qual because it looks a bit more user-friendly. But yeah, I mean, the general feedback has been pretty good for this. Obviously, we won't see the fruits of this until we start receiving the portfolios in for those registered on the new qual, which went live, obviously, Jan 2020. So we're probably looking at another 12 months before we start seeing those filtering through.
Yeah. All right, come on.
Is it possible to switch the client, the trainees from the previous qualification to the new one, or do they need to re-register?
Well, no, they would need to continue on the qualification that they're currently registered. I mean, the certification end date for those registered pre-Jan 2020 is not until the 31st of December 2022. I'm not for 1 minute advocating that you want your candidates that were registered before that, you know, working up to right to including there. But we do think that that's ample opportunity and time to complete qualifications that they would have been registered on pre-Jan 2020. But no, it's because the learning outcomes in the assessment criteria have been changed and the qualifications have been redeveloped. It's under a completely new Ofqual code. I mean, if we ever got to the instance where we have candidates that for whatever reason have not completed and achieved by the 31st of December 2022, we've not certificated, then a mapping exercise would obviously have to be carried out against the OL and the new qual, and then we'd have to look, obviously putting that candidate onto the new registration code. And then obviously, because, you know, we can't have units submitted across the two quals, the examiners will certainly not be able to examine and it wouldn't meet the criteria.
No, thank you.
Anybody else got a question? Hi, David.
Hello. Hi. I suppose this is slightly separate from the portfolio itself. I'm kind of just taking this opportunity just to ask, really. The last 2 days, I've had a lot of emails from students very anxious increasingly anxious about coming into college. And I can imagine a lot of tutors can possibly relate to this. I imagine that'll increase over the next few weeks. I'm just wondering if ABC, or even if you're aware of any from BACP guidance on, if it comes to it, on delivering classes remotely. I feel as though, I think the benefits of doing it face-to-face are massive. It's a counselling course. It's a person, I'm delivering a person-centred counselling course. I think that is definitely preferable. But there's this tension between, the delivery of things face to face, but also the health and the risk to students. I'm just wondering if ABC have any guidance on that, how to straddle that, or if there's anything at all out there really.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the problem that we've got there, as you know, is things are changing so fast and they're changing day to day. So no sooner do we get some advice and guidance from the BACP and we speak to the other warning organisations, things change rather quickly. So what we put out there tomorrow may well change by the end of the week. But as I pointed out earlier, we are being as flexible as we can, and we are permitting remote client stroke supervision work to carry on until further notice. And looking at the general geographical picture, I don't see that changing or ending anytime soon. So all we can do is to just keep updating you guys in terms of what we will permit in terms of the remote client hours.
But is that, more the remote Derek, classes?
Yeah, David's talking about the teaching hours. Is this something we've got? Because when the lockdown came in March, we had two forms that people could apply for. Are they still going? You know, do they have to, if they're changing their assessment task, do they need to let ABC know? Am I right? I don't know if they've changed.
There is a form on the website that centres can complete and fill out if they want to change, obviously, the assessment method that they would usually use. And that is normally dealt with rather quickly by compliance. It will be, in all probability, yes, because you'll put forward, a scenario in terms of how you want to meet that learning outcome and assessment criteria differently from the way that you were previously delivering it. But what I'll do, David, is I will send you a link to the adapted assessment method form in case you are thinking of doing that, but you've not yet submitted it. Turning around that request really quickly. But we are accepting them, and we've received them from lots of centres.
Okay, great. Cheers.
Can I just, sorry.
No, you're all right, Bethany.
Yeah, we're just thinking that, I think the government are quite reluctant to close schools and colleges, so I think we just have to just really wait and see and just watch. And I think as long as colleges are really following the guidelines in terms of, social distancing, then I think just carry on and try to be as safe as possible.
I think though, even though colleges are encouraged to be in, not all learners can be in every week because they have to self-isolate for so long, or they're ill, or they've been in contact. Mm. So, I mean, obviously, each of the centres will make their own provision for that. Mm. But ideally, you can teach face-to-face, but that can be also transmitted over Teams so that people at home can be watching it. And I think for that reason, we have to accept that some people will be doing their training online. You know, I've got somebody who's immunosuppressed and just isn't happy to come in at all, and we have to understand that. So she's constantly watching it online, and we've had to put other things in place for them to do their skills work via Zoom or Teams and make sure that there's a tutor around to ensure safety. I think it's just about being really flexible and adapting to individual needs as well as full centre needs.
Yeah, we're a very small independent, and our centre that we've been using for the last however many years is not big enough. So, of course, we've moved everything online, live online, as we say. And I suppose the question is more about currently, because of the health of a number of our students, just what you were talking about, Trudy. Not only that, we've got staff who, you know, in similar situation. So how is this going? I mean, I think the students are getting as good a deal as they could get, given the situation. But in terms of training hours, do they all have, you know, do these however many, let's say 450 for ease of number, do they all have to be face-to-face? I'm sort of in that land of uncertainty at the moment.
Okay, well, it's actually, for this qualification, it's currently 300, but the new qual is 310, guided learning hours. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they have to be face-to-face with you, but they have to be working on something that you've directly guided them or instructed them to do at that time.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and then the total qualification time is any extra time they give.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you. I've been waiting to have that clarified. I feel very happy. Thank you.
Good.
Hello. I'm an individual provider as well, and I was actually using a school, which obviously I can't use anymore because it's not deemed safe. So I moved to a hotel, which is obviously now going to be closed due to the lockdown, and I have been I've done a lot online as well, but the only thing that I'm concerned about that I think is different, obviously, with the online provision is the skills assessment, because obviously normally we would take people face to face, and I'm thinking about the new level four group that just started, and now obviously can tape it online if we still can't get them face to face by the time they'd be due to tape that assessment. So that's the only area, really, the skills overall, if we can't get students face to face to assess them, that's the only area that I'm a bit concerned about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and again, I don't think it's something that ABC can particularly guide you on, but I think it's about us as centres trying to be flexible and think around how we can do those assessments. So you may want to, because, you know, the online systems that we've got allow for going into separate rooms.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're very good, so you might be in a separate room with two learners and observing and assessing their skills, doing it that way.
Yeah.
It's just as long as you can evidence how you've assessed it and how they've met the criteria, that will meet moderation requirements.
Okay, that's great.
I think on that point, I know compliance have responded to quite a few requests relating to this, but I think, you know, the observation statements which we can be put together by the tutor to get that assessment decision would be wise to complete. We wouldn't ask for a recording of a Zoom session, let's say, that you'd you would normally face to face, but the observation statement, the template that's on the website, you know, ideal to be completed to back up what has gone on through that session in terms of it being delivered via Zoom or whatever it might be.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. That's great.
Yeah, it's really helpful. Thanks.
Anybody got any other questions or any other comments? Has it been useful?
Can I just ask about placements? So the first, Susan Simpson, so the first year students that have come on board in September, so they're starting to now look at placements, although they won't be going out into placement until after Easter next year, are finding it more difficult now coming into this second lockdown. Placement providers, because they're so busy, they're not coming back with any answers. So I just wondered about placement provision. So we're tending to use GP practices, they're coming forward.
Yeah.
I just wondered if anybody else has got any ideas, really.
Does anybody want to come back to Susan on that? Or any suggestions, put in the chat box. But yeah, I can imagine that that's going to be an issue for some learners to get a placement, yeah.
I think as well, because existing students that went into lockdown in March that might now have finished, ordinarily haven't finished, so they're sitting in placements, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, even before we recruited this time, we were telling learners that they may not start their placements as early as they would have done.
Mm.
Placements might be done very differently, but that we would just support them through to the end of it, however long it took. And I think, like with everything, we're just having to be really flexible. But we're finding some of the bigger organisations like Mind, or Beacon, or some NHS organisations that we work with, they're doing it really well. So they are allowing their trainees into the centres, into the placement organisations to do the work, but they're doing it remotely. So the clients are not coming in. But it's taken a while for them to get on board with that. I think things have only just really started working quite smoothly now.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see whether this more recent announcement changes things or not.
We have a GP practice where they go into a room at the GP and they use telephone counselling.
Yeah, yeah. And it's quite impressive, actually, that some GP practices are still doing that, because I've found that GP practices were the first to close and the last to open. They don't want to let anybody in. and as centres, it's a juggling act, making sure that the students are adequately supported, because some placements are asking them to work at home remotely, which I don't think is fully safe for trainees, and definitely not for first-year trainees. But those, I think, are decisions for each centre to make for themselves about what support they've got in place for the trainees.
And I think it also depends on what their other job is.
Yes.
I've got a number of social workers on our first year course this year. And of course, they're dealing with clients all the time remotely. So in fact, the social work part of the group, they found placements much already quite easily through different contacts. But I just want to say, I'm impressed that you guys somewhere around the country have GP practices that have counsellors. We definitely don't in Bedford, not one. Go to Mind, CET. I can't believe it. That's amazing. I can't wait to tell my students we'll have to move, because that's what we need to do. So interesting what you hear in these days, isn't it?
I think a lot of the GP practices that we work with, and we're in the Northwest, have been set up for trainees in the past. Because they don't have the resources to pay people, so they are usually manned by trainees with one qualified counsellor who oversees or mentors.
That sounds so good.
So I just wondered if it'd be useful for me, and I'm sure for Trude and Darren, just to get some feedback on, you know, how is, has this been useful? Is it, you know, been too long, too short? You know, has it met your needs? Because obviously if it's a success, we can put it on again and maybe give, you know, about the new qualification and give a bit more notice. So it'd be good, whether you do it now verbally or put it in the box, it'd be good to get some feedback, wouldn't it, Trude?
Yeah, definitely. And I think as well, one of the positives of the very unusual situation we find ourselves in is that we've adapted and we're doing this. in the past when we've tried to get something together, it's always been about logistics and people getting there. Well, actually, now we know that that doesn't matter. We can do this again if you tell us what we need.
I think it's been really useful, thank you. I'm wondering whether we could have regular tutor meetings.
Yeah.
Where we could share.
Yeah, that would be
really
great.
Good idea.
So yeah, I have just put a couple of questions in the chat there, and it's good, you know, that we are doing this now. And I personally, from my previous working experience elsewhere, have delivered quite a few of these on a regular basis. It's something that providers have always been willing to attend, and I think moving forward, a really good way of getting everyone. We know that the events that we put on yearly or twice yearly, you know, we have to put those on in different locations, and it does mean that predominantly you're losing a day of your time, which is extremely, you know, you're extremely busy at the moment. I think something like this 2 hour, in terms of, you know, not speaking for everyone, but attention span, I think 2 hours is just about perfect to cover these things. And as Jude Allison said, if there's themes that are occurring regular and things that we pick up on the reports and the examiner reports that Alison puts together, then we could literally quickly put one of these together. So I think it's a really, really good idea. It'd be great if you can put as much feedback as you can into the chat, and I can collate that and obviously get these delivered on a more regular basis.
I would just like to feedback that it's been really useful, and thank you very much. And Darren, did I understand you correctly? This is being recorded, and this recording will now, I presume it'll just be an audio recording. The recording will be distributed to everybody in the group.
Yes, it will be. We'll edit what we need to edit, and we will obviously make sure that compliance are happy, and then we'll determine where we're going to share this, whether that be directly with you individual, or whether we paste it on the website. But that will be something for compliance. But yes.
Oh, okay. So. And also there was mention that Alison had produced a feedback report. I haven't seen that before, Alison. I presume it's somewhere in my centre. Would you be able to release that individually, Darren? Or
that's the examiner report that collates based on all the feedback that we've had over quarterly report from the examiners. But it is on the website. But what I will do is I will send that out. I'll send a link to that report to everyone, all the approved centres, later today.
Yeah, it's really useful to have a look at, and it says where the pitfalls, what people are getting referred on. It's very detailed. It's been built over years, so it's really useful tool for you. You know, and this is, for me, it's been really good because, you know, it's not common practice for the examiners to have that direct sort of dialogue with centres, but it's really good to get your feedback. As I say, if there are those niggling issues that you think haven't gone away, like Lorna was saying, get in touch with ABC and they'll link with us. Or the other route, if it was about other matters or even about some of these, is you will all have a moderator attached to your centre as well. I don't know, moderation has changed because it's all been done remotely, but there's another resource person there that if you needed to ask questions, you can do. But yeah, I found it very, I'm a bit nervous doing it at the beginning, but I found it very valuable and very informative both ways as well, because ultimately we want to get these learners passed, we want to get them through, and all of the examiners, that's their motivation for doing this work. It's one, for me, maintaining standards, but getting your learners through. And obviously, you know your learners very well, and I don't. But we're just trying to, and I think with the new qualifications, I think the pass rate will go up. I think, you know, the bits that we have changed needed changing and needed updating. They've probably been there for 15, 16 years in the same format. So I think that change will help as well. And I think this format's good if you're sole providers, you know, to link with other people. I think it's a good idea at some stage if tutors can link up, especially if with the remote suggestions or, you know, good practices or what works online. That could be really good for all of you, really.
Yeah. That sounds like a really good idea, actually. I just wanted to say thank you, because the one thing I will try always to make an ABC meeting a day, you know, training day or this, mainly because I always get a feel that people are listening. You know, other awarding bodies who are out there don't have the same experience. And, you know, that I can say something, it gets listened to non-defensively. You know what, I can't do more than that, because then I can model that for my students. And, you know, that's superb. I truly mean that.
That's very good to hear. Thank you, Lana.
Thank you.
Sorry, if I just quickly say, because I also need to see the clients, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's very good. Just two very quick points. One, I have always found the feedback very, very useful, right? As a joke, one of my tutors said that is so good that there was a candidate years ago whom we thought would never pass. It's the feedback literally held that person's hand and said, you do this, yeah, next time do that. And the person passed, right? Regarding evaluation and analysis, it's I got the definition from your feedback and I gave it to the students in the very first session and keep on repeating, this is what you need, right? It's not looking for our own definitions. This is what's needed from this perspective. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very useful, right? Sorry, I need to leave because the other computer is clicking, right?
Thank you. Yes.
Bye. Thanks, Belinda. Take care.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it as well. I've enjoyed just talking to other tutors, to be honest. It's nice just to hear other people asking questions and just being part of that discussion. Even if I'm not talking myself, it's nice just to be having this conversation, honestly.
Thank you. Thanks, David.
Right, thank you. Hope we'll do this again soon.
Thank you for joining.
Okay, bye. So
Darren, is there anything you want to say before we close?
Yeah, just obviously to thank you once again, everyone, you know, for your time today, which, you know, is nice. And I'm sure you'd agree that it's been a very valuable session. As we've already pointed out, that the session has been recorded and this will be made available for you to refer back to. And obviously for those that have been unable to attend today. But if you do have any additional questions that you didn't think of during the session, that you want answering to or that you didn't want to raise during the session, then please do send them to me and I'll endeavour to get you obviously a response as soon as I possibly can. But on that note, once again, thank you very much. I think it's been great and hopefully we can do these on a more regular basis. Trudy, Alison, thank you very much as well. You know,
thanks, Darren.
Yeah, thank you. How
busy everybody is. And this was put together at short notice. So have a great afternoon, everybody. And if you need anything, you know where we are. Let's try and make this next lockdown a little more pleasurable than the last one. So, all the best, everyone. You know where we are. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Darren.
Bye.
Thank you, Trudy.
Bye.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.